Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Coming up this hour, Philadelphia Union knocked out of contention for the MLS Championship, but what a game. And as Hanukkah comes to a close, we'll speak with a South Jersey rabbi who says there's hope for those struggling with addiction in the story of the Festival of Lights. But to begin, we're talking about the unrelenting increase in racism experienced by Asian Americans since the start of the pandemic. Just last week, hundreds of people marched from Philadelphia City Hall to school district headquarters after four Asian American students were attacked on SEPTA's Broad Street line. 18-year-old Christina Liu was badly beaten after she stood up to the assailants, a group of teenage girls between the ages of 13 and 16 who have since been charged with aggravated assault and ethnic intimidation. Leaders of the Asian American community are calling for more protection on public transportation and accountability from the school district. Joining us now are Philadelphia City Councilperson Helen Gim. Welcome back, Helen.
Thank you. Good morning.
And Joey Chen is a student at Central High School. Welcome to you as well, Joey.
Hi, good morning.
Helen, first to you, this increase in racism against Asian Americans has been with us since the start of the pandemic. Doesn't seem to be easing at all?
No, I mean, to be clear, the level of anti-Asian violence that has spiked since the start of the pandemic, but also with the rhetoric of a former president who used hateful, vitriolic, and violent rhetoric against immigrants and Asian Americans all over has permeated our culture. You know, you've got radio hosts and, media franchises spewing really scapegoating rhetoric about Asian communities, and that has had a long-term impact. There's no question that the violence that we're seeing, especially with an economy bottoming out, a pandemic, and the spate of violence all over the nation, has resulted in attacks on Asian Americans at an alarming rate. It's been shocking, and more, they've been targeted towards women and girls in particular. Which has been really upsetting.
Joey Chen, what are students at school saying about the attack?
So I feel like a lot of peers and I are saying how it's really sad how this increasing violence is happening towards Asian students, and especially how we feel as though community leaders oftentimes don't really listen to the youth, because we are the ones that are directly affected by this violence. We are the ones taking SEPTA. We are the ones that are affected, but we're oftentimes not listened to. And oftentimes community leaders would try to have more policing and increase in that kind of enforcement, but that's not really what we wanted, because we feel as though we need more funding in education, which is much more important than increasing in policing.
Are you feeling that teachers and administrators at school are hearing what students are saying at all?
I feel like admin isn't really listening, because the solution that came up with admin is increasing cops and having one police officer on one subway train, which isn't really a long-term solution at all. I feel like some of my teachers do try to listen to what we are saying. They would have the effort to get me and my peers together and listen to us, and have organizations listen to us as well.
We've got a statement from the Philadelphia School District. Let me read it in part here. The School District of Philadelphia has zero tolerance for bullying and harassment of any student, and we are committed to providing learning environments where all students feel safe and welcomed. Our policy includes a variety of supports for students who may feel subjected to such offensive and harmful behavior, as well as for those who are aggressive and bullying other students. The statement goes on to say, the assault that occurred against a School District of Philadelphia student November 17th as young people were commuting home from school on SEPTA is appalling. Students who do not attend School District of Philadelphia schools have now been charged. Helen Gim, what do you make of this?
Well, let me be clear that our young people are really hurting right now. Our young people have witnessed the vitriol, hate, scapegoating, and violence around them, and it is really incredibly painful to see young people, of the ages that were involved, in the crime, at such a young age. And one of the things that I think Joey is saying very clearly is that we really need to focus on what's happening with our youth. They have been home for more than 16 months. They are now riding a transit system that is at 30% of its former ridership. Almost 70% of former riders of SWFTA are not currently on it. And they cannot be expected to simply, go back to a sense of like, it's not a surprise that normalcy is elusive right now. And so there has been a lot of discussion in the school district and amongst communities and driven by young people that they need greater supports in schools, more opportunity to knock, to talk to one another and kind of reclaim the social structures that make young people come into community with one another. And that these public spaces that we're on, particularly public transit, particularly public recreation centers, parks, our streets, and our public schools are important spaces for young people to relearn, reacclimate to one another. And what we are seeing more than ever is that that's not happening. We've got more than 1,900 vacancies across the school district of Philadelphia alone. We are missing huge chunks of our school population at a time when young people need it the most. So it's clear that there is more work that needs to be done. It's clear that the school year needed to start with re-engagement and support and mental health and real investments in young people. And finally, the last thing I'll say is that even the young women parents, the ones who assaulted, not just Christina Liu, but really went after these young men who are on the subway in a really, disturbing way. But they also are alarmed. They went and made sure that they contacted law enforcement.
Yeah.
They are also recognizing our young people need help.
Yeah, I watched the video, and one thing that struck me was that these very young women were angry as they allegedly attacked Christina. So if we're going to prevent this sort of thing from happening, are we going to have to get to the root of some of the anger that some young people are experiencing? And is there enough bandwidth within the Philadelphia School District and elsewhere in the city to provide counseling and preventive mental health care? Helen?
Yeah. I mean, for me, there's no choice. There is no choice. There isn't a question of whether you provide or how you provide. You need to shift resources into this area. There's no question about that. I don't think people understand the damage that violence has happened, that violence has a lasting impact on shaping young people's experiences. And again, I just want to emphasize, Christina was not the only actual victim, and she wasn't, although she was the one who was witnessed on the video that many people saw on social media, there were actually four young men who were the targets of these young women's ire at the beginning. And they had been, stalked and harassed and threatened and all of this stuff. And it was very upsetting. And I think that's why Christina happened to step in, because she is a young woman who's been very active in the Asian American youth community, who's been active in her school, and she felt like she needed to act. But there's no question that these young men who are being attacked also felt like, they hunkered in. They protected each other. They did everything right. And so, they were very strong and resilient for themselves in that moment. We are going to teach our young people to get some help, they need help from other adults around them to help them, come back to a sense of sanity and humanity that we, our city, is feeling like we're losing right now.
Joey Chen, are you concerned about safety for yourself and for your friends?
I feel like a lot of us are afraid, but afraid because that the increase in violence in our city, and we feel as though that there should be more funding in the schools because we need places for healing. Like, all these things are really traumatizing to all of us, and like, just talking about it makes me cry, but like,
take a moment.
But yeah, I think we're just really traumatized with everything, and we just need space. And
do you feel you have support immediately available to you, Joey, to help you and your friends work through this trauma?
I feel like not enough sometimes, because I remember the day, the day after we came back to school, like, our teachers just went straight back to lessons. Like, sure, they gave us space, but, like, it was like they just asked us, oh, do you want to talk about it? Like, I don't want to talk about it in front of all these students, you know?
Yeah. Helen, you know, this is there's obviously a lot of pain, and still the question of what happens immediately to address this pain. Are you in conversation with the school district yourself?
You know, right now I've been focusing a lot on the young people. You know, there's something to be done about the school district. It's always been ongoing. I think we've been raising these alarm bells from get-go. Last spring, we launched a youth-driven anti-violence agenda that talked about mental health supports in schools, a whole formula, and laid out a plan and vision for the school district of Philadelphia. I think Joey's pain and the pain that so many young people are saying right now has got to wake the city up to the need for us to invest in our young people, in supports, their programs, and increases in mental health supports and counseling that we can be doing. But also there's just like the need for them to be surrounded by other adults who are really doing mentoring programs, after school programs, job supports, and the robustness of love that surrounds our youth. That I hope, Joey, that you're feeling for myself as, you know, like somebody who's just deeply committed to seeing young people thrive. I mean, I hope that there are listeners out there who want to sit up and say, like, we've got to take this on. We cannot allow violence to destroy generations. And there are things we can do. It's not just, I think, as Joey said, it's not just about policing. It's about investments at the school level, at the classroom level, that have to occur, and that there are roadmaps for that. This isn't rocket science. It's actually getting the job done in our schools, staffing up, making sure that there are after-school program supports. And I think we can see a change, but we have to make it a priority.
Joey, we don't have a whole lot of time, but I do want to ask you if you are feeling confident that you can attend school today, tomorrow, and with some sense of safety and hope that things might change.
Yeah, I definitely do hope that things will change, because this is an ongoing violence that has increased, and like people are being affected by it every day, and like we're just getting like light shed on this type of violence. And I just do hope that like city councils and city officials are recognizing the violence that students, that youth are facing every single day. And like definitely need, like Helen was saying, like we definitely need more funding of school districts for different programs, for curriculum changes, like implementing Asian American studies or like ethnic studies, because that is really necessary and important.
Joey, we're gonna have to leave it there. A strong message today. Thank you so much for joining us, Joey Chen and Helen Gim.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Today marks the final day of Hanukkah, the 8-day Jewish holiday, also known as the Festival of Lights. The story of Hanukkah dates back to 164 BC, when a small group of poorly armed Jewish warriors overcame the mighty Syrian Greek army to recapture Jerusalem and their temple. When they attempted to light the temple menorah, they found only enough purified oil to last one day, but miraculously, the one-day supply lasted 8. Our next guest is a rabbi from South Jersey who draws a parallel between the Hanukkah story of the triumph of light over darkness to his own personal struggle with opioid addiction and his 10 years of sobriety. Rabbi Michael Parise is rabbi for the congregation at Temple Sinai in Cinnaminson, New Jersey, and he's here with us now. Welcome.
Hi, Mary. It's my honor to be here with you today.
Oh, well, thanks so much for joining us. Rabbi, you are a relatively young man who happens to be celebrating a decade of sobriety. We'll talk about how this has impacted your congregation in just a moment. But first, your story. How did you first encounter opioids?
So my story is like millions of Americans. It's innocent but tragic. I was a Temple University student and I was a commuter. I lived in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and I was driving home from school one day and I was stopped at the bottom of a red light. And it was at the bottom of a hill and there was a person behind me who was on their cell phone. I could clearly see them on their cell phone and I just knew they were going to hit me.
Oh gosh.
And I did the one thing, doctors or anybody says you shouldn't do, which is brace for impact. And I was hit, and the accident was pretty bad. I had whiplash, shoulder issues, but the real issue for me was this kind of disc issue in my lower back, which would cause horrible nerve pain down my right leg. So after a couple weeks of kind of like waking up in the middle of the night in this horrible pain, I said, "This is enough. I have to go to a doctor." And they prescribed me to a low amount of opiates, but it's ironic, pain medicine for its name doesn't actually treat pain, it only masks it. And what I found relatively quickly was that my pain kept on intensifying and I needed more and more.
Yeah. So eventually you found yourself addicted to opioids. And as a matter of fact, so many people go from pills to heroin. When one of your suppliers, Rabbi Paris, dropped off heroin instead of OxyContin, what went through your mind?
Yeah, so let me just say first that this is a part of the tragedy of opiate addiction. It's a very expensive addiction, as I can attest to. And unfortunately, or sadly, heroin is very cheap in America. And when people reach a point where they can no longer access these prescription pain medicines, they don't really feel they have any other choice. So I went into this horrible withdrawal. And I know for many of your listeners, they can't really understand what an opiate withdrawal is like. And the only way I can truly describe it is like, what if I took away your food? What if I took away your water? How long could you go? Could you go 12 hours, 24, 36? How long until you're doing anything and everything to get the thing that you feel like you need to survive? That's kind of what addiction does to a person. And I ran out of every possible resource. I say, you eventually hit a wall where you've told every lie you could tell, you've borrowed every dollar you could borrow, and you just kind of hit this wall. And I couldn't find anything, and I was going into this withdrawal, and a friend of mine, he knocked on the door and he brought me a bag of heroin. And I had never done heroin. It wasn't on my radar. It wasn't something I was expecting to do. But I felt in so much anguish. I was in so much physical pain. I would have done almost anything to make it stop. Just, I wanted it to stop. And so I was walking to my bathroom. And this part is like really hard to talk about. I almost find myself at a loss of words because it's so hard to articulate. Because I want your viewers to understand, your listeners, I was in an immense physical amount of pain. And almost in like a moment, I felt this calming sensation come kind of like wash over me. And I had this moment of clarity. It's the only way I know how to describe it, a moment of clarity. And I just knew in that moment, if I did this, I was going to die. I didn't know if I was going to die then and there. I just had a feeling that my life would be forever changed. And within a moment, I took the heroin, I flushed it down the toilet, and I called my parents and I said, "I'm in a really bad way. I need help."
What was their response?
They were shocked. They were shocked. They were upset. They knew I had taken low levels of opiates because they knew I was in a very bad accident and they knew that I was dealing with pain, but they had no idea how severe it had gotten. And you kind of become adept at hiding addiction. It becomes kind of like your necessary skill to maintain the thing you need to survive. And so they were very, very upset. But more than anything, they just wanted to help their son. They wanted to help their son. And this was 10 years ago. The stigma of addiction was, it's bad now. It was really bad then.
Yeah, as
It
a
was
matter of
so
fact,
bad.
I was going to say, you told producer Susan Greenbaum that when you entered treatment, you decided against inpatient rehab.
Yes. So I was convinced that if I did inpatient treatment, it was going to ruin my life. I wouldn't be able to get a job. I had, it's funny. You don't think of the addiction of ruining your life at the time, but it's inpatient treatment. And so I'm very lucky. My family has resources many families don't have. I was able to see an outpatient doctor literally the next day. And I sat in his office and he looked at me and he said, listen, we're discovering new things about specifically opiate addiction every day. And 80%, he threw a number like that at me, you know, 80% relapse cold turkey. He said there are new medications, which is called medically assisted treatment. He said, you know, it's new, but if you follow my regimen, I believe it will save your life. And to this day, I believe that was true. I believe the medicines they prescribed me at the time saved my life. They were able to help me deal with the withdrawal, deal with the physical pain I was having, and then eventually kind of get myself to a place where I could start rebuilding my life again.
You had actually, I understand, turned away from your faith shortly after your bar mitzvah. I mean, becoming a rabbi wasn't even on your radar. I mean,
not even close. I say that if there was a list of things I thought I'd never be, it was NFL player followed by rabbi. And I know people can't see me, but I'm about 5'0", 150 pounds. So yeah, it was, you know, as far as anything could be. I was raised in a Jewish household. My family owns Jewish funeral homes. Judaism and Jewish culture was a big part of my life, but sadly, you know, my rabbi is more notorious than famous. He had his wife murdered in the 90s. It's a famous story. You know, his name was Fred Newlander.
Yeah.
You know, that had a very negative impact on my view of rabbis and Judaism. So, yeah, after my bar mitzvah, I was pretty much done with it.
So would you say that experience that you had, let's go back to when you felt this sense of calm as you decided not to accept that bag of heroin, would you describe that as a spiritual experience? And then would you describe your journey, you know, through and away from opioid addiction to becoming a rabbi?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And, you know, I don't tell anybody, you know, if I was to hear this story years ago, I don't know what I would have made of it, but I know what it means to me. And as I was going through that intense withdrawal, you know, remember, I'm a secular Jew. I don't have a relationship with God or faith. I remember kind of like angrily yelling at God, like, why do I deserve this? What did I do to deserve this? And just being really angry with God in that moment. And when that moment of clarity came, for whatever reason, I connected those two moments. And as I was kind of in this process of refinding my faith, you know, I felt like, is there a reason to this? Do I have a purpose? You know, I really kind of believe that I was given a chance to do something with my life, and I didn't want to waste that, and I thought that was something special. And so I didn't know what that could be, but it turned out to be something more miraculous than I could ever have imagined.
So let's get to your decision to share your story of addiction with your congregation. That must have taken a lot of deliberation and not a little bit of courage.
A lot of deliberation and a lot of courage, though it didn't feel like that. It felt more like scared out of my mind. You know, this is something that I wanted to do for a long time. When I was in rabbinical school, I had a mentor, a professor. She was one of the first LGBTQ rabbis to come out of the closet in the 80s. And I remember, you know, having this conversation with her about, you know, how did she know when to do this? When was the right moment? And she told me, she said, I'll never forget. She said, when you're in a place when you feel loved and supported, you'll know. Don't feel rushed to do this. And so, you know, in June 2020, I was hired by Temple Sinai of Sinaminson. It's a beautiful community in South Jersey. These are just down-to-earth, loving people. And I felt exactly what she said, love and supported. So, you know, it was a combination of that, 10 years of being liberated from this horrible addiction. I saw myself as so blessed. But more than all of that, I felt like if I could save even one life, Mary, just one life by sharing this story, how could I remain silent?
And so have you found that, oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, have you found then that congregants are opening up to you about their challenges with addiction?
That was the amazing thing. You know, you think because you've gone through an addiction, you wouldn't be surprised that other people are going through it. But even before I kind of you know, disclose this information. Many of my congregants were telling me how, you know, their children were dealing with this issue or their grandchildren were dealing with it. You know, this is the silent epidemic. This is the epidemic that, like, we don't talk about in America. And we know from the stats that over 100,000 people died from opiate addiction last year. I mean, this is almost a form of insanity that we feel like we can't talk about these issues. And that's why I'm a firm believer that until we change the stigma of addiction, we can't get people into treatment, these life-saving treatments that exist. But, you know, and so that's why I always say you don't have to feel guilty. You don't have to feel ashamed. Nobody chooses this life. So, you know, if I can deliver that message to people and say, hey, if it happened to me and I'm a rabbi and I, you know, from, you know, all intents and purposes, I am doing pretty well in my life, you know, you can too. And so that's why I just kind of, you know, share that message with as many people as possible.
Let's get to the connection you make between Hanukkah and recovery. You know, it is a Jewish holiday, but I'd like to, if you don't mind, use a wider application to any of our listeners who might be grappling with addiction. You know, the triumph over seemingly impossible odds.
Yeah.
And again, the analogy to the struggle many people face. I mean, no one would have thought the Maccabees would have beaten the Syrian Greek army.
And for
the person who's in the darkest corners of addiction, and, you know, many people don't make it, Rabbi Paris. I mean, how do you draw the connection? Where do you give them hope in this story?
Yeah, this Hanukkah story is illuminating, no pun intended. You know, the Maccabee story is a story of survival. It's a story of hope. It's a story of believing in oneself and overcoming these kind of, like, overpowering forces. That, in a nutshell, is how I would describe recovering from opiate addiction. You know, you feel so beaten down. You feel so broken down by this addiction. You start to believe that there is no hope and that you wallow in this sense of despair. And the Hanukkah story reminds us that, you know, if you believe in something, if you have just the right amount of allies and support, and if you have that belief that anything is possible, you can overcome. And, you know, I heard in your intro, you know, you talked a little bit about what the miracle of Hanukkah was, which is, you know, this rededication happened at the holiest temple in Jerusalem, where there was only amount of oil to light the menorah for one day, yeah. And it lasted 8 nights. And, you know, when we think about ourselves, we don't give ourselves credit for having reserves, resilience, more than we could ever imagine within ourselves to survive, to overcome. You know, I think people are often are not really sure of themselves in these kind of situations. Can they do it? Do they have the strength, the inner strength? And yeah, faith and religion can play a huge part in that process, but it also comes from deeper, and that comes from within. And I think that's spiritual. I think that's God. I think that's whatever you want to call it, the universe. But it's a powerful reminder that you know, we do not have to remain in the darkness, that the light is waiting for us. And the Hanukkah story is a great symbolic representation of that.
So, you know, people who are in recovery are in recovery for life. I mean, 10 years along, Rabbi Paris, I mean, honestly, yeah. Do you have concerns about maintaining sobriety? And if so, how do you address them?
So we need to, like, change the narrative of addiction, because every addiction's different.
Okay.
There's so many varieties of addictions, variants. You know, my addiction is not this type where I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning and feel like, oh, I'm in a bad mood, I'm going to go take an opiate. I just don't feel like I would do that. My fear, having started this with an injury, is that that might happen again. You know, that's my greatest fear, that I'll be in a car accident or I'll be in a situation where I'll be in an immense amount of pain. And, you know, the truth is, I pray that day never comes. If it does come, I will face it with all the knowledge and information I have now. But yeah, it, you know, this is the kind of, these are the daily struggles of people who are in recovery. You know, this might be a little too much information, but, you know, I was in the hospital with kidney stones, not too long ago. And, you know, you hear all these stories about how people can't get opiates anymore. Well, they were trying to push it on me. And
oh,
I
boy.
said, And I said, you don't understand. I am not taking these medications. Come back to me with another solution.
What did they do for you? Because believe me, kidney stones, I know from experience, some of the worst pain ever.
Worst pain ever. And, you know, it was kind of reassuring in the aftermath to feel like I made it through that. They do have, you know, very strong, non-narcotic medicines, very strong Tylenols and Aleves. They had something that just barely got me through it. But that is definitely one of my ongoing struggles. And, you know, my faith keeps me going. And, you know, we can't also stigmatize the fact that, you know, a lot of people started these addictions with injuries. They might have to go through that again. And, you know, we can't shame people. We have to just treat people to get them better. And I think we're learning more about opiates, that they're not really the medications to treat short-term pain.
Sure.
That, you know, that's, I think, a mistake a lot of pharmaceutical companies kind of pushed on the doctors 10, 20 years ago, was that these medications really were miracle drugs when they weren't.
Yeah,
a lot of people were lied to.
We certainly know a lot more. So we've got about 30 seconds left, Rabbi Michael Parise. If somebody who's listening to this conversation is trying to deal with the stigma and the shame, does not want to come out about their grappling with addiction or family members, what is the first step? How would you counsel them?
I would say that, first off, seeking counsel is a great first step. Reach out to people you trust. People can contact me. You know, I always say that there's nothing to be ashamed about. You've done nothing wrong. I can't stress that enough. You've done nothing wrong. You're just a person in a very bad situation, and you need the help you deserve. That is what I would tell them.
Rabbi Michael Parise, well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mary.
And happy Hanukkah.
It's been my honor. Thank you.
Rabbi Michael Parise is rabbi of Temple Sinai of Cinnaminson. Up ahead on the regional roundup, for the first time ever, the Philadelphia Union soccer team made it to the Eastern Conference Final. Great game. They didn't win, but lots worth talking about. We'll be speaking with professional soccer player and analyst Danny Higginbotham and Jonathan Tannenwald of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It was a valiant effort on the part of the Philadelphia Union, who were defeated 2-1 by NYCFC on Sunday before a sellout crowd at Subaru Park. At stake, the MLS Eastern Conference title. The Union putting up a Rocky-like effort after health and safety protocols forced the benching of at least six of its starters, including one of Major League Soccer's best goalies, Andre Blake. It was the farthest the Union have ever gotten in the postseason. So what happens next? We're going to get some analysis and open up the lines. 888-477-9499. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email us at radiotimes at whyy.org or tweet us at whyy Radio Times. Joining us now, Jonathan Tannenwald writes about the Union for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Welcome, Jonathan.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And Danny Higginbotham is primary color analyst for the Philadelphia Union's broadcast team and a former Premier League player. Hi, Danny.
Good morning. How are you both doing?
Oh, we're fine. Thank you. So what a game. A half dozen starters out. The guys who played fought so hard. Danny, first to you. What are your thoughts?
It was nearly. I think everybody went into the stadium, you know, probably hoping for the best, but expecting the worst.
Yeah.
But the performance that they put on, I thought, was magnificent. And it just really sums up Philadelphia Union as a club. I think it sums up the Philadelphia area, as in terms of the underdog status and things like that, the workmanlike side of things. And they gave an unbelievable account of themselves, and for the vast majority of the game, were better than NYCFC. So the fans will be very proud. It was just under the circumstances, because it looked like everything could have been written in the stars after what happened with NYCFC going to New England during the week. But yeah, then as the week went on, things just got worse and worse in terms of the plays that you've mentioned being out.
Jonathan, did you have a chance to sense the emotion running through this team after the loss?
It's tough to do because the pandemic, and obviously even more so with the issues the team has had, we all had to sit in the press box and be on a Zoom call. But absolutely is the answer to your question. I, admittedly, being a not a native Philadelphian, I don't like the Rocky tropes. I never have. But Danny is right. What we saw yesterday was an incredible display of guts and heart and all those other intangibles that Philadelphians love to rave about when their teams lose valiantly. That was absolutely that. But Danny knows and has seen just as I have, this team also has a lot of skill and creativity and ingenuity.
Yeah.
And Jim Curtin, the manager of this team, who's one of the best and smartest managers in this league, he had a hunch that his team was going to do better than the cliches and the critics were saying, and he was absolutely right, Danny.
Well, you know, before we get to Jim, and I wanted to do, I'll do that in a moment, let's get to those, the health and safety protocols that forced the implementation of, you know, Plan B,
right,
if you will, I mean, a.k.a. COVID protocols. I mean, what do we know about this, Danny?
Well,
or Jonathan, sorry.
Danny, can I take this one if you don't mind?
Of course, I would love you to, because you probably know a lot more than me about it.
So the rule in Major League Soccer, unlike a lot of the other U.S. sports leagues, is that the teams cannot disclose whether the players have COVID. The players have to do it themselves first, and none of them have done so yet. And the rules apply not just to do you have COVID, but are you a close contact? Were you engaging in high-risk behavior? It actually says in there, it could be any non-COVID illness. The only things we know for sure, one of the veteran reserve players, Ilsenio, admitted on his Instagram page that he tested positive.
Okay.
And we know that they're starting right back. Olivier Mbaizo tested positive last month when he came back from, actually, I shouldn't say, we don't know that he tested positive, but he was out for quite a while quarantining. And
sure.
He had been gone to the Cameroon national team in World Cup qualifying. One of his teammates there tested positive and was unvaccinated.
Okay.
And there's a belief in Africa, in Europe, because a number of his players play in Europe. There's a belief that he infected a bunch of players, one of whom was potentially the Union's Mbaizo. He came back, was sidelined for a week and a half, which is how long you're out if you have COVID, in the air quotes that I'm doing. It's radio, so of course you can't see that. But this was actually, and Danny, who works on the Premier League and the Champions League games on the national broadcast here, this was quite a scandal in Europe. This particular player being unvaccinated, Eric Maxim Choupo-Moting of Germany's Bayern Munich, was very well known.
Yeah.
And the effects seem to still be cascading around the global game.
Well, the effects of COVID are cascading,
right.
You know, apparently it's safe to say probably that COVID unfortunately hobbled the Union. Danny, if things were different, if they had the starting team, if they had Andre Blake in goal, would we be talking about a very different story this morning? And it's speculation, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think so. One of the things I would say about NYCFC is that earlier on in the season, they came to Philadelphia Union, and Philadelphia Union beat them 1-0. But I remember speaking to JP, who I work with, and I said to him at that time, even though the Union NYCFC 1-0, they were the best team that I'd seen come to Philadelphia Union. They were my so-called underdogs for winning MLS Cup. But then what we saw on Tuesday transpire, I remember watching the game. NYCFC went to New England, dominated the game, should have won the game within the 90 minutes. It went to extra time. It went to penalties. Their top goal scorer, their main man, Castellanos, got sent off. So you walk away from the end of that game thinking, right, okay, NYCFC, they've just had to play the full 120 minutes. Castellanos is now suspended. Everything works and looks in the favour of Philadelphia Union. So then what happened was, I think obviously on Thursday and Friday when things started to come out about what was happening with COVID and what have you and the protocols at Philadelphia Union, things started to turn then, and I think it seemed to be that it was, you know, certain players, none were named at the time, were going to be out, and then the list just seemed to get bigger. and that just made things so much worse. But what I would say, because I know we're going to come on to Jim Curtin in a minute, is that he's one of the most humble, nicest human beings that I've ever had the pleasure to be in his company and to speak to on a regular basis before games. And one of the things, when I spoke to him on Saturday night before the game, he made no excuses. he didn't say anything. He's always about next man up. He said to me that the definition of a professional is to be ready when you're called upon. And he will be so proud of his team. But it's so many what ifs, because in my opinion, if Union were able to have their strongest team out there, I think they would have won the game. And I think they would have gone to Portland. And Jonathan, correct me if I'm wrong, but they beat Portland 3-0 earlier on in the season at home, I believe. And, you know, they will have gone there full of confidence, but it wasn't to be. And now they have to bounce back from that and lick their wounds and prepare for next season, which is going to be coming earlier than the seasons usually start in MLS.
Now, what does the preparation look like, Jonathan? What are your thoughts?
5 or 6 weeks they're going to be starting preseason. I want to say one thing to Danny. Yes, the Union beat the Portland Timbers here in late May. Yep. There's a big difference between playing here and playing in Portland, which is the very best soccer city. As much as I love Philadelphia, Portland, Oregon, yep, is the best soccer city in the United States. It's the best stadium in the United States, the best atmosphere in the United States. It will be a TV show to rival anything anybody's ever seen in world soccer on Saturday when Portland hosts New York in the championship game. But I want to, Mary, to a point you made about Andre Blake a moment ago, I would actually submit, as great as he is, he was only about the fourth most important absence out of the players who were gone.
Okay, so who else?
Four-fifths of the starting defense was out, including the two center backs and the left back. Those three guys, I think, were all, and Danny, you can add to this if you like, I think those were all even more important than Andre Blake's absence. They had to put a 20-year-old rookie right back at left back. They had to play a reserve who'd only play a handful of games as one of their center backs, and the other center back, a 35-year-old veteran who's been in the league for a long time, won an MLS Cup in 2013, one of only two players in the Union's locker room with a ring, but had played 1 minute all year, and before that, not since 2019. And he went out and was unbelievably good.
That's Aurelien Collin.
Yeah, Aurelien Collin. Danny, what did you think of the center backs yesterday?
I thought they were exceptional. I thought both Finley and Collin, what they did the simple things, but you could tell the experience that they'd had. And on numerous occasions this season, I've been down to watch the training. And one of the things that's really stood out to me is that players, even if they weren't playing, even if obviously as a player you're not happy when you're not playing, they were second to none in terms of the approach towards training. And that showed on the pitch yesterday. And just to add to what Jonathan said, I think personally, and this is just my personal perspective, is that if Union would have had the forward line out yesterday missing rather than the defensive line out, as good as Collin and Finley were, I think they would have had a better opportunity. Because if you look at Union's defensive record, that's been key to them getting where they got, getting as far as they got, the success that they had, especially at home. They haven't conceded more than one goal in such a long time in the home form. And when you look at it, it's not about the individuals. It's about the collective. And as Jonathan's quite rightly saying, you know, of your regular starting back five, if you want to include the goalkeeper, only one of them was available yesterday, Baizo. You've got Elliot and Glesnes. You've got Blake. You've got Wagner that gives so much, not just defensively, but attacking-wise. You've got Bedoya, who is the heartbeat of the team, is the epitome of a captain and a leader on and off the pitch with the young players, how he organises the team. And then when you look off the bench as well, one of the things that Union have had recently is a change of direction off the bench. If they want to try and speed the game up, you've got the likes of Santos, you've got the likes of Berg that are off threatening behind. Union didn't have that to a certain extent yesterday. So it was really tough. But what I would say is that every single player that came off that pitch, that entered that pitch yesterday, been so disappointed afterwards, but they can hold their head up high, because every single one of them to a man gave an outstanding performance. And in my mind, you know, a 9 or 10 out of 10. And NYCFC didn't play well, and that wasn't because NYCFC
they looked sluggish. They looked sluggish in the first half.
That was because of Union, in my opinion.
That's absolutely right.
Don't be. Unfortunately, I have to watch the clock. So what I'd like to do, this gives us real hope, folks who are Union fans, for next year, and to look ahead as to how this team might assemble or even reassemble a bit for next year. I wanted to talk about the Union Academy for a moment, maybe as a side, and what that produces. I mean, we saw young midfielder, a rookie, Jack McGinn, who made an outstanding play during the Nashville shootout, a couple weeks ago, whatever. He's a product of the academy, which has trained other standouts. Tell us a bit about the importance of the academy and who's coming up through there to the union team moving forward.
So the union run their own high school in Wayne, just about a few minutes from the King of Prussia Mall. And the kids are in class for half the day, and they're playing soccer half the day. And the classes, I've been out there a number of times. The classes are actually high level. They've sent a number of kids to Patriot League schools, Ivy League schools, Big Ten schools, et cetera. But the quality of player, professional player, that the academy is producing is exceptional. I mean, a lot of professional teams in America, in MLS, are producing players out of their youth academies, which is how it's done in the rest of the world. It's not college sports in England, where Danny grew up, and Germany and France and all the countries in Africa and South America and so on. Clubs have youth academies. They develop the players in-house, bring them up, and start to play them at 19, 18, 17, sometimes 16 and 15. You can turn pro in soccer in America at a far earlier age than you can in any other sport in this country.
Yeah.
And the quality of kids that the Union's Academy is producing. You mentioned Jack McGlynn, who, Danny, I've never seen an 18-year-old take a penalty in a shootout quite like that. I don't know if you have. But him, Paxton Aronson, who's the brother of Brendan Aronson, the former Union star.
He's now on the men's national team.
Elite, yeah, with the U.S. men's national team. Quinn Sullivan, who is another Union midfielder who's got multiple generations of soccer bloodlines in the city of Philadelphia, not just the area, but the city itself. And I'll mention about Brendan Aronson, by the way, one of four guys from the greater Philadelphia area who might be on the United States World Cup team next year. All four have ties to the Union. Yeah. That's an incredible track record.
And Brendan's from, I think, Medford, New Jersey.
Correct,
so he's
yes.
a local guy.
They're all local, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, for those of us who walked away disappointed, you know, yesterday afternoon, this is really making us all feel a lot better. Danny, to you, though, you know, for a moment, talking about Jim Curtin again, there are reports that FC Cincinnati is looking to lure him away with the head coach job there. Any indications that Curtin would be tempted to leave?
No, I have no indications whatsoever. But one of the things that he stated is that, and we saw it last end of season, Mark McKenzie, Brendan Aronson, who you've just mentioned, when clubs are doing well, players will be in the spotlight, managers will be in the spotlight, and that is, it's sort of a double-edged sword because it's great because it means the team's doing well, but it means that there's always going to be other teams looking. So, yeah, you know, Jim Curtin is from Philadelphia, is obviously very proud. I think there's still room for growth in this team is in terms of the trajectory and the direction that they're going in. As Jonathan has just mentioned, the young players coming through. Jim Curtin's seen it all. He started off in the academy. He's progressed through. He's bringing the younger players through. You've got Marlon LeBlanc, who looks after Philadelphia Union 2. He's progressing young players through. And I think that so many clubs within MLS are envious of Philadelphia Union and their identity. And I've seen it from both sides, interviewing these people behind the scenes to do with the youth and the academy side of Philadelphia Union. And then when my son came over to visit, he trained with Philadelphia Union 2 for a number of months as well. So I saw it from that side. And it's a club that is on the up. And, you know, we saw last season what they did. They lost two of their best players, but they progressed again this season. So it's going to be an interesting off-season in terms of what players come and potentially what players go. But I think the future is very bright for a club that needs to be mentioned more around Philadelphia as well, because we know how big the
yes.
sports are.
Yeah, you know, agreed. You know, front page, right? Danny Higginbotham, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. Great to have you with us.
Thank
you so much for joining us. Danny is a primary color analyst for the Philadelphia Union's broadcast team and a former Premier League player. Jonathan Tannenwald, our thanks to you as well.
A pleasure to be here.
Jonathan covers the Union for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Our engineer today, Diana Martinez. Today's show produced by Paige Mary Bessler, Debbie Builder, and Susan Greenbaum. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, good to have you with us. Take care.